Alaska's lone seat in the U.S. House has been held by the same congressman, Don Young, for the last four decades. Democratic challenger Forrest Dunbar wants to change that. I'm Lori Townsend. Alaska's congressional seat has not been held by a Democrat since Congressman Nick Begich died in 1972. What change would Forrest Dunbar bring to Alaska's representation in Washington if Alaskans voted to send him there? Forrest Dunbar is our guest today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Alaska's congressional delegation is currently a bipartisan mix, one Republican, one Democrat in the Senate, and one Republican in the House. Forrest Dunbar hopes to change that mix. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Forrest.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Sure. Thanks for being here. I wanted to let people know we offered Congressman Young equal time on Talk of Alaska this week, but his staff said his schedule didn't allow for it. So, Forrest, you grew up in Alaska when you were small. You lived
yes.
in Eagle, and then grew up primarily in Cordova. Give
yes.
us a glimpse into that upbringing and what led you to run for office.
Sure. So I lived until I was seven in Eagle. My mom was a teacher, and my dad was a fisheries biologist with Fish and Game. Although, sort of funny, he didn't actually work in Eagle. He worked in Igiagig on Lake Iliamna. He would go there every summer. And we spent one summer in Igiagig as well, which was also a pretty formative experience for me. And then when I was seven, as I said, we moved to Cordova. And that's where I went to most of elementary school. It's where I went to high school. That's sort of what I consider my hometown. After I finished high school, my parents moved to Fairbanks for 10 years, but they've recently moved back to Cordova. So I get to go back there and see my friends and see them. And I live in Anchorage now. I've lived here for the last couple of years, but I still consider Cordova my hometown.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-8255 to join our conversation if you have questions for Forrest Dunbar, Democratic challenger for U.S. House. Or in the local Anchorage area, 550-8422, 550-8422, or you can email us talk@alaskapublic.org. So, grew up in a village, now you live in Anchorage. What made you decide to run for office?
You know, it's an interesting question. I've been asked it a number of times, either what caused me to run for office in general or for this office specifically. And I don't have what in my mind is sort of a good, satisfying, clear answer for the former. It's just something I've thought about for a long time. I've been involved in policy and politics for a long time, since I was about 17. And I've been sort of politically aware since even before that. So my parents, we would watch the news together and we'd have some political conversations, even going back to when I was an Eagle, when we had RatNet, which I think some of your listeners probably remember.
Sure.
The Rural Alaska Telecommunication Network, I think
Still
it was.
Going
now
on.
Now it's ARCS, I think is what it used to, at least that's what it was called when I was in Cordova. So I've always been kind of politically engaged, I think. And then I got more involved when I came back from law school. When I was in law school, I started coming back to Alaska in the summers. And I worked at Alaska Legal Services and a couple of private law firms. But I was also getting more involved in local politics. And I'd already had sort of the D.C. experience. I'd been intern and a paid staffer in D.C. on the Hill. But I got started to get more involved in local politics. And then I did a session in Juneau. And while I I was there, I think I started to get noticed by some other people about, well, maybe you should run for this or that, and started to have those conversations. Ultimately, it led to me having conversations with people in D.C. as well. And it made sense, given my background and my experience, the fact that I had kind of the rural upbringing and the rural values, but I had this unique opportunity to go to D.C., work on the Hill, build a network there through my graduate program as well and my law program, that I knew I could do that job well. And I actually had more experience in D.C. than I did in Juneau. So that was what motivated me to run for this particular seat. It was a job I knew I could do well.
Well, that kind of answers my question that I was going to ask as a follow-up. Why decide to dive right into the deep end with a U.S. House position rather than starting maybe with city assembly or something like that? You haven't held elected office before.
Sure. Well, you know, it's funny that there's sort of two answers to that. The first is what I just said. I have the D.C. experience. It's where I know I could be most effective for the state. But the second part of it is, you know, there are relatively few places for young people to actually get involved in politics in Alaska. We have the same number of state House and state senator representatives as we did at statehood. That number hasn't increased, even though our population has vastly increased. We don't have any elected DAs. We don't have any elected commissioners. We have no elected attorney general. To run for a city council here in Anchorage, a borough assembly, rather, it's 2.5 times the size of a lot of state House seats. To run for school board, you have to run citywide in a city of 300,000. So if you're going to live in Anchorage, and I wanted to live in Anchorage because this is where a lot of opportunities for people, for attorneys and for other people are, I wanted to live here. There just weren't a lot of opportunities, to be honest. And I felt like I was from Alaska. I didn't necessarily feel like I was from Anchorage at that time when we first started running. Every day, every week that passes, I feel more and more connected to Anchorage. But I haven't lost that connection with the state as a whole, and I still felt like it was appropriate for me to represent the state as a whole as opposed to sort of one section of Anchorage.
1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. You can join our conversation on Talk of Alaska today. Forrest Dunbar is our guest. He's running for U.S. House. And 550-8422 is the number in Anchorage to call and join our conversation locally if you have questions. Forrest, you're running as a Democrat, but how would you describe your own brand of politics?
Well, you know, independents and undeclareds vastly outnumber Democrats or Republicans in this state. And I've always considered myself fairly independent. Maybe I won't use the word maverick. But, I don't feel strongly that one party has all the answers. That's clearly not the case. And I've worked with and for Democrats and Republicans. I worked for a Democratic congresswoman. I worked with Republican state senators when I was not for, but with. And I believe that good ideas can come from either side of the aisle. And that's an idea that's very powerful in my generation. I think partly because of the last 6 years and the really bitter partisanship we've seen, and I would argue was driven mainly by Mitch McConnell, though I know some other people would disagree with me, but the use of the filibuster for excruciatingly partisan means has led my generation in large part to turn away from partisan politics. And it's why the unity ticket this year, I think, is such a powerful idea for a lot of young Alaskans. I do think millennials, and I'm a millennial, which is typically people between the ages of 20 and 34, and I'm 30. I think the millennials are going to break strongly for the unity ticket. And part of the reason why is we want to send a message that we don't want this kind of bitter partisanship anymore. We want people to be working, sort of across party lines and trying to move past partisanship as much as possible. Now, I'm not naive. I know that parties, as long as we have the structure and the system we have today, parties are going to exist. But I do think that here in Alaska, we have an opportunity for people to vote for who they think would do the best job and would represent them the best and be most ethical or effective, rather than one party or another. That's still a very powerful idea here in this state.
Mm-hmm. Talk about about your campaign strategy.
Sure.
You don't have a lot of money. How are you prioritizing to get your message out there?
We don't have a lot of money relative to my opponent, who has a lot of corporate sort of lobbyist donations from Washington, D.C. in that area. And this is not a slander. It's in the FEC reports. You can go look. It's very clear. We have, not counting the current report, which hasn't come out yet, we have a little over 1,000 individual Alaskan contributors. Don Young has 121, right? So clearly we have taken a different approach. And we've actually raised quite a bit more money than I think people thought we did. And because of that, we've been able to go on to the radio. We've done a lot of digital advertising. We've done a lot of direct mail. If you haven't received a piece of direct mail, it might be we don't think you are a swing voter. Or perhaps we weren't able to find you and target you and get the message out. So clearly we're going to be outspent probably 3 or 4 to 1. We're going to have many more Alaskan donors. And we've done a pretty good job, I believe, of getting that kind of grassroots support and running a fairly positive campaign. Now, there are certainly times when we've been tough on my opponent, but frankly, he's been tough on himself more than we have. Somebody commented to me recently, we didn't have to go negative because he kind of did it on his own. Frankly, a lot of the things that he did this summer, there were several incidents. Any one of those would have ended Mark Begich's political career. Any one of those would have ended my political career. And the truth is, we hold Democrats, because they're a minority here, we hold Democrats to a much higher standard. They have to be accountable or they're removed. That doesn't seem to be the case with Don, but hopefully things are changing. And we've got to get out there and put forward a positive message that lets people know that there's a real choice, a real alternative, that I could do a good job and be effective for the state. And that's been our primary challenge, is getting people to know who I am, where I'm from, and that I will represent them and fight for them.
Democratic challenger for U.S. House Forrest Dunbar is our guest today on Talk of Alaska. We're going to take a call now from Eagle.
Oh, wow.
Sonia's on the line. Good morning, Sonia.
Sonia Sager?
Yeah, it's definitely me. Hi, Forrest.
Oh, my gosh. It's so long. How is Iris doing?
She's doing great.
That's
awesome. I don't have a question for you. It's just a glimpse back into the past.
Yeah.
Growing up in Eagle, we had a great neighborhood where the kids all played together and built forts in the woods. And the four families on our blocks had... They had 10 kids between them, and all the parents were good friends.
Right. I remember.
So us older kids had a rivalry with the younger ones. The headquarters were under a tall spruce tree at the edge of the meadow near the old red barn. And it was a formidable gang of five-year-olds, consisting of my sister Iris, Jed, and Forrest.
A gang of five-year-olds.
We had a lot of fun terrorizing you guys with water balloons and pit traps.
Yes, you did.
We always knew that we were totally outmatched in the brains department. So I just wanted to say that those were three of the smartest little kids that I have ever known. And
Thank you, Sonia. I hope we get a chance to see each other again. I know it's been a long time, and I understand you have several children now. Am I correct?
Yes, my husband and I are raising six children.
Oh my gosh!
Here at Eagle, and
that's wonderful.
Yeah, you know, I just remember when you wore tiny cowboy boots and little plaid shirts.
Don't tell anybody about that.
My son is that age now and wears those little plaid shirts, and it just reminds me, you know, and really what you've reminded me is that candidates are foremost people. And yeah. I know that you won't forget your rural subsistence roots when you get to office.
Thank you, Sonia. I appreciate that.
Thanks for the call, Sonia.
That is the best call I have received on any on any radio program that I've been on so far. That's awesome.
It also leads quite nicely into my next question, but I want to give the numbers again so other people can call in and join us. 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 550-8422. 550-8422 in the Anchorage area. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. It sounds like Sonia was sort of part of your early shaping to get ready for the rigors of politics by bombing you with water balloons. And
well, so. it is something that's kind of remarkable. So this little block, as Sonia was saying, this little block in Eagle, there were four families, and they all had kids about our age. And I look back at just how remarkable... How do I say it? And I know. So Iris now is a very successful wildland firefighter. Jed Brown, who she referred to, who was my age, has a PhD from the University of Zurich and is a researcher for the Argonne National Laboratory. And it's just kind of remarkable to me. You know, there is incredible potential and incredible human capital out in the rural areas that sometimes goes untapped. And that's something that I've always carried with me. That the knowledge that despite the kind of fancy degrees I went on to get, I wasn't the smartest kid on my own block in Eagle, you know. I mean, there's just these incredible, talented people out in rural Alaska.
All that great salmon oil helping the brains of all these rural people. You gave a speech on Saturday at AFN, the final day of AFN. And during part of that, you said that if you something along the lines that if you married an Alaska Native woman and moved to a village, you would expect that the tribe would have something to say about how you behaved, how you behaved yourself there or treated your wife. What kind of legal authority do you think tribes in Alaska should have in their communities?
Well, that was a reference to a very specific law and a very specific exception to the law, which is the Violence Against Women's Act, which was put in, the exception was put in recently. And I think our senators are now trying to get it out. And I would very strongly try to remove that. And what the law basically says is for other parts of the country, if you are a non-tribal member, but you live in a tribal community and you have an intimate relationship, typically a marriage, but it could be some other very intimate relationship with a tribal a spouse or what have you from the tribe, the tribal court will have some authority over you and some jurisdiction over you. And I support that. And especially if you commit a crime of domestic violence, that's somewhere where the tribes have a say. And, you know, the thing about it is out in rural Alaska, and actually out increasingly in urban Alaska as well, there is a lack of law enforcement. We don't have the public safety we need. We are understaffed. We are undermanned. And so I'm very supportive of things like VPOs and VPSOs. But there just aren't enough. There isn't enough resources from the state or some of the boroughs to cover some of those areas. So we, if we have an organization like tribes that are saying we can step up, we can have tribal courts, and we'll run them appropriately, and we will work with the state to make sure that there is some form of due process there, then I think we should embrace that. We should work with them to provide public safety, because it's a huge challenge out in rural Alaska, and unfortunately, as I said, it's also increasingly a problem in places like Anchorage. I think people would be shocked by how few police officers there are on the streets at any given time. I've done several ride-alongs with the APD. I was very proud to be endorsed by the APDEA, their employees association. But it really is a problem here in Alaska. Public safety is a large issue, and we should be reaching out to as many partners as possible to try to bring them on board and provide that critical public safety.
I'm sure that you're aware of a scathing report that came out about public safety in rural Alaska, law enforcement.
Yes, the Indian Health and I'm blanking on the name
Indian
of it.
Law and Order Commission.
Indian Law and Order Commission. Right. Yes, thank you.
What do you think the federal government's role should be as a, if you were a member of Congress, what would you advocate for? Would you favor sort of a quasi border that tribes could sort of police and assert authority within a certain region? There's no reservations here except Metlakatla. So the territorial differences are much softer here legally than they are in the lower 48. It's more clearly defined there.
Other than Metlakatla, I don't think anyone is really talking about creating a reservation system. However, there is issues with Indian land and land into trust. And I think the important thing to remember is this is land that they already own, that not the tribes in all cases, but the Native corporations, for example. It is their land. And they want to perhaps have the option to change how they police their own land. But it is their land. That's not, you know, there's no mistake about that. It already is. I think they should have the option, if they so choose, to put it into trust if they, again, if they choose. And not everybody will. But if the legal option should be available. This will increase local governance, which is something I have strongly advocated for. You know, local governance at the city level, the borough level, in this case, in the tribal level. I think it has some potential. It's certainly not a silver bullet, and there are other things we need to do. Now, the role of the federal government. In some cases, the federal government needs to get out of the way. I mean, we've had plenty of talk about development and about regulations and some of the mistaken regulations. But in other cases, they can be partners, and we should always try to have stakeholders at the table. When we're doing something like, say, Port Clarence, which we're hoping to go forward, some people are hoping to go forward with, and I believe I would support Port Clarence.
For an Arctic port.
That's right, for an Arctic port. We need to be talking to the tribal organizations of the three villages that are going to be directly impacted. You know, why weren't people in Teller more closely? I'm sure it's a he said, she said. When I was at AFN, I had someone from Teller come up to me and say, we were not consulted, and we are very worried that Port Clarence is going to harm our food supply. And they rely on the marine mammals that come in to their community. And that's their, they've lived there for 1,000 years, you know. So it's not that we are aren't going to go forward, but we need to consult and work through and have all the different players and all the different parties at the table as much as possible. And I would say that one of the reasons I am supportive of the unity ticket is I think our current state leadership has often fallen short on that notion, on consulting with the locals, consulting with the tribes, consulting with other organizations at the local level. They seem to have consolidated a tremendous amount of power in the state and in the governor's office to a degree that I'm not comfortable with. When we are going forward with a project, we should have local buy-in.
We're going to start taking a few calls now. We're getting more callers on the line. 1-800-478-8255 is the number if you'd like to join us for a question for Forrest Dunbar, who is running as a Democratic challenger to U.S. Congressman Don Young. 550-8422 is in the local Anchorage area. Tom is in Homer. Good morning, Tom.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a concern about the electrical grid. It's substandard, obsolete, and vulnerable to solar flares and nuclear bombs and sabotage, that type of thing. And we have 600 of those nuclear power plants scattered around the world. And what I'm wondering is what's your plan for dealing with these issues?
Thank you, Tom. Well, it's certainly true that our grid is not as modern as it should be and needs to be modernized also for energy efficiency reasons and for reliability issues. So I was just yesterday, or perhaps it was the day before yesterday, I was meeting with Golden Valley Electric in Fairbanks, and they were talking about how they need a second intertie between Willow and Healy so they can have better reliability. And that goes up and down the state, that we have critical infrastructure needs when it comes to running power lines. And we are vulnerable. And I perhaps wouldn't focus on the nuclear aspect, but I would focus just on natural disasters, on an earthquake or a bad winter storm. We don't want people trapped without power. Moreover, modern grids and smart grids can help us conserve energy, which is crucially important. We need to bring down the cost of energy statewide on the rail belt, but of course in the rural areas as well. And we can do that in part by modernizing and updating our grid. And so I've met with Homer Electric Association. I took a tour of the Nikiski facility. There are some great opportunities that are coming online. We've had great success with Bradley Lake on the Kenai. I'm hoping that we can build a gas line, as a lot of people will. And so that will help to hopefully lower energy costs along the rail belt. But it won't do as much as it could if we don't also update our grid, our infrastructure, and perhaps try to run power out to the rural areas as well to start bringing down the cost per kilowatt hour.
We have another caller in Homer, Amy. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. I think that a candidate's character and how he relates to the public and to Congress people in D.C. makes a lot of difference. And I know many people have heard about what Don Young said at the Wasilla High School. I don't know whether very many people have heard what happened in the debate at Kodiak, and I wondered if you would describe how Don Young and you acted before the debate.
Sure.
When you were walking together.
Sure. So this was reported in the ADN. They came to me a couple of times asking me for my story because I had sort of alluded to it during the course of that Kodiak fisheries debate. So the story in ADN was basically correctly reported. And I'll say it was an unpleasant experience, and I probably didn't act as mature as I should have. But basically what happened was we were walking up behind the stage waiting for Dan Sullivan and Senator Begich to complete their debate. And I can't remember how we started speaking, but he said something to the effect of, this is going to be funny considering our call her earlier. He said, you're not really from Cordova, had you looked into. And I guess our last call was from Eagle, not Cordova. But the point is, he said, you're not from Cordova anymore. I'm from Fort Yukon. You know, had you looked into. And so I went up to him and I sort of touched him on the arm and said, what are you talking about? It's a very strange thing to say, considering there's a mountain of photographic evidence of me growing up in Cordova. And then he sort of lost lost it. He shouted at me and he said, you know, don't touch me, don't ever touch me. The last person who touched me ended up on the ground dead, which was a very, obviously a very strange thing to say. And I remember I kind of got this flushed feeling in my head, and we started kind of yapping back and forth a little bit. And I'm not sure of all the details there. The witness, the one witness who was there, sort of corroborated the things that were reported in the ADN. But I think I lost my head a little bit. I'm sure that he did. And I think that was sort of his intention. He was trying to get under my skin. Then we went out on stage, and the fisheries debate was impassioned, but I think it went pretty well. And we got a huge boost in support after the debate. So I think it kind of backfired. We just had on Congressman Young, we had a debate yesterday in Fairbanks. He was much more mellow. There were basically no shots fired. It was a pretty almost boring for the audience, I would say.
Well, that's sounds like a better tone for everyone, yeah. To have a more statesman-like debate.
Sure.
Forrest, you lived in Eagle when you were very young, and yes. Then grew up in Cordova, as we yes. were just hearing about. What are your thoughts about native subsistence rights, what yeah. many in rural Alaska call food security?
Yeah, I am a very strong supporter of subsistence and of food security. And it goes beyond just the food, of course, so that's a very important part of it. It's about a lifestyle and a culture that has existed for thousands of years. And I know here in Anchorage, sometimes there's this perspective of, oh, they're getting, I don't know, they're getting handouts or whatever. But I remember when we were in Eagle, but the people in Eagle would use the fish that came up the river and their fish wheels to feed dog teams. And that was subsistence. And they would have dog teams for transportation. Now, sometimes not enough fish make it up the river, so you can't feed your dog team. So what do you got to do? You have to get a snow machine and put gas in it. Now you need more cash. We're forcing them onto the cash economy and away from a more traditional lifestyle. I think that's wrong. It doesn't make economic sense. And it also doesn't make sense sort of for the character and the culture of the state. So I believe in a rural subsistence preference. I also believe that for those Alaska Natives who are forced into Anchorage or to the Matsu Valley or Kenai by, say, a medical condition or by the high cost of energy in the bush, they shouldn't lose their right to go back and subsist traditionally, to go back and work a fish camp, for example. If you have a family where their fish camp has been there for 1,000 years and now they have to come in to Anchorage and live for a couple of years while someone recovers at ANMC, they shouldn't lose their right to go fish that fish camp. But in general, I'm very supportive of subsistence rights and of for both food security and for the cultural aspect of it.
Let's get one more call in before we take a short break here. John is in Anchorage. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Do you have a question?
Yes, my question, I'd like Mr. Dunbar to respond to the newspaper article this morning that suggested more than $51 million is being spent on the Senate campaign.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, I have to admit, I haven't read the specific article. I saw the headline. We came out very strongly. My campaign came out very strongly early on in, I believe it was March or April, about campaign finance reform. It's always been an important part of my campaign. I think it's very worrisome, the idea that we would have this much outside spending in Alaska. And I'm not saying there shouldn't be any outside spending or any spending from PACs, for example. But this new system created after Citizens United with the super PACs and these unlimited just flood of cash, basically trying to purchase our Senate seat. I think that is very worrisome for our democracy. And I would like, and I wrote a piece about this in what was then the Anchorage Daily News, about reforms we could make even within the structure laid down by our Supreme Court. And let me be clear, Citizens United is a mistaken decision. It is the wrong decision. It is unoriginalist. Originalist judges would not have said that the First Amendment ratified by our founders gave those kind of rights to mega corporations. It just wasn't in the cards back at the time of the founding. So it was an unoriginalist decision. I highly suggest everyone read Justice Stevens' dissent there, which lays out all the reasons for it, why it's bad law, but also bad policy. But post Citizens United, there are still things we can do at the statutory level to make things better and get us hopefully back to that one person, or at least closer to that one person, one vote ideal. And this is not something that is a Democrat or Republican issue, although certainly it appears the Democrats are more eager to change this system. And that's why I signed the last Constitution pledge, why Mark Begich did, why the Republicans haven't, because it appears that this new system has benefited Republican candidates. There are some statistical evidence of that. But if you read the book, and I suggest everyone read that if they get a chance, read the book Republic Lost by Lawrence Lessig, and it lays out the details of how this new system of campaign finance frustrates people on both the right and the left, and ultimately is bad for our democracy.
All right. Forrest Dunbar, Democratic challenger for U.S. House, is our guest. We'll be asking him a lot more questions and taking your calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the historic Anchorage Hotel, offering space for rehearsal dinners, engagement parties, business meetings, or social gatherings. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. HistoricAnchorageHotel.com. And by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, with health plans designed specifically for Alaska businesses. Learn more at primera.com/newalaska, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and our guest today on TOA is Forrest Dunbar. Forrest is the Democratic candidate for U.S. House. Forrest, I read a story on KNOM's website that sort of laid out your thoughts about drug policy. It was interesting to read your ideas about the war on drugs and the DEA, money to states. I know that the DARE program has also been one that has had a lot of financial impact in schools. What do you see as problematic about these programs?
Well, I mean, it's hard to look at our current system and not come to the conclusion that the war on drugs is a hugely expensive failure. We're not actually reducing drug use in a lot of ways. We have a huge prison population. We've given up a ton of our civil liberties, and we've allowed the federal government to come into our state much more than people sort of, I think, appreciate. I mean, the DEA, and there are good people who work for the DEA, certainly, and they're trying to do good work, but they are enforcing policies, I think, that have failed and have been hugely expensive. And so when I was working on this issue in Juneau, you know, we had a lot of support from Republicans because they were fiscal conservatives. We just built a $250 million prison, $250 million prison near Anchorage called Goose Creek. It's going to be full by 2016. So what are we going to do? Are we going to keep building new prisons, or are we going to try to address some of these issues and maybe take a different approach? That's not all driven by the war on drugs. There are other reasons that people end up in prison in Alaska. But a lot of it is. A lot of it is driven by the war on drugs. I think ultimately what we have to do, and it's going to be a long-term process, but other countries have done it and seen more success, is shift away from this idea that this is a criminal justice matter primarily, and more a public health issue. Why are people addicted? Why are they turning to drugs? What is the trauma in their life? It's usually a trauma that they're trying to self-medicate. It's why you see so many veterans who are drug users. It's why you see a lot of people in rural communities, and particularly Alaska Native communities, who are using some kind of substance because there's a history of trauma there, maybe historical trauma passed down generation to generation. Those are the real issues. It's not one substance or another. I also don't like when people get caught up in, oh, it's this substance is so bad, this substance is so bad. You know, people will get high on gasoline if they have to. People will get high on vanilla, drink vanilla extract. I mean, they'll do whatever it takes if they have that addictive personality and there's some kind of pain in their life they're trying to deal with. My approach is more education. So there are certainly good programs that go into schools and try to convince people not to use. And perhaps I've never smoked anything, not even a cigarette. So I maybe I was persuaded. It's hard to say, but I do think education, law enforcement, and treatment, those combined. When I say law enforcement, I mean like community policing. Those three things combined are proven more effective than jail time and actually getting people off of drugs. So this is a long-term process. There are people who have strongly differing views on certain aspects of it that I respect. I am yes on two, and I know there are a lot of people that are no on two, and some of those reasons are legitimate. And some of those people I really respect, like Bill Walker, like Senator Begich. They have come out no on two, but I do think we need to take a different approach, and it's something I've done quite a bit of work on and research on. And again, I want to bring it back to the fact that we still have a lot of drug use here, and it costs us a huge amount of money to try to stomp it out.
We'll stay on that theme for just a moment.
Sure.
Fran in Anchorage has a question along similar lines. Good morning, Fran.
Good morning. Yes, thank you for answering the question where you stood on the marijuana issue.
Sure.
My question is, as a Yale law graduate, and reading the law the way it is written that we will be voting on, do you feel that the rural communities will be able to deal with the legalization? Since the way the law reads, it's very ambiguous with regard to what will happen in villages that cannot enforce the law, and they will get the drugs coming in. Now, I'm debating whether to vote. I'm a baby boomer. You're a millennial, and I have a millennial son. I've seen ramifications of both pros and cons.
Yep.
So please tell me, what do you think will happen in a village if it becomes legal?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before you answer that for us, I'd kind of like to preface that thought with, I was going to ask a similar question because I won't name the village, but on one of my reporting junkets out to a village, I was riding with a VPSO officer, and we went by a home that had marijuana plants laid out, a small grow operation. And I said, you do know what those are, right? And he said, yes, but I don't worry about that. He said, it's when alcohol comes in that I have trouble.
Right.
I don't have trouble with this. What are your observations growing up in Cordova and knowing about rural Alaska? And to answer Fran's question here.
Sure. So it's sort of two different issues. One is to what degree the rural areas can restrict legalized sale of marijuana, which is what the ballot initiative allows in communities that want it. And the other is sort of the effect of marijuana and the lived reality of people in rural Alaska. So I wrote a piece about this in the Juneau Empire a number of months ago. And my experience growing up in rural Alaska is there are drugs and alcohol there. And not every part of rural Alaska is the same. I should preface, I want to say that clearly. My experience in Eagle and Cordova is very different from someone who lived in Quinnahock or lived in Klawak or lived at Point Hope. So, rural Alaska is not a monolith. There's an incredible diversity. Some parts of rural Alaska will choose to accept legalized commercial, the sale of marijuana legally. Some won't. Now, to follow up on your point, when I was working in criminal justice and just when I was living in rural Alaska, the violent crimes I saw were almost always alcohol or some other kind of drug. I can't remember a single case where someone said, I went home, I smoked marijuana, and then I assaulted my wife. It just didn't really happen unless there was some other reason or some other substance involved. We don't need to go into the effects of alcohol in the villages. Everybody knows it, and not just in the villages, it's all over Alaska. But I also don't want to demonize alcohol either. I mean, we have good craft breweries all over the state that are doing good work, that are local businesses. So it's about when you abuse a substance, not necessarily when you use it, responsibly. But to get back to, so it doesn't surprise me that a VPSO said, if they want to smoke marijuana, that's vastly preferable to someone getting drunk and stumbling on the street. But getting back to Fran's question, and the reason that I am supportive of ballot measure 2 is because I do believe that the ballot initiative is written, and we can interpret it in such a way because this has been said publicly so many times by the supporters of ballot measure 2 and by those who oppose it and by people who are sort of neutral, that this gives a local option to opt out of the commercial sale of marijuana. Now, what we'll do is we'll default back to the current system under the Raven decision, which still allows people to keep some marijuana in their home. That's not going to change. If we pass the ballot initiative or we don't pass the ballot initiative, that's not going to change. But the legal sale of it and distribution of it, which is going to be permitted in communities that want it, I do believe that the regulation, the law is written in such a way that it's clear that small communities can opt out. And I'll say one last point on this. Regardless of who wins in the governor's race, I think they will appoint a regulatory control board that will strongly lean in that direction. And I hope to work with that board if I get the opportunity to make sure we have very strong regulations that give that local preference and that local control. Because as someone who supports ballot initiative 2, I don't want to see these kind of nightmare scenarios happen. That's how we'll lead to recriminalization and people getting incarcerated again. I don't want that. So we'll create a strong system that leans in the direction that Fran wants us to lean, I believe.
All right. Forrest Dunbar is our guest today on Talk of Alaska. We're moving around the state. We're going to Fairbanks now. Rich is on the line. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. I'm really, really enjoying this. I really enjoy listening to Forrest. I think he's a remarkable young guy, and I know a lot about what he says, and I already voted, so I'll make full disclosure. I already voted for him, but
I wanted to point
out something in today's Readers Supported News. There's an article by Robert Reich called "Empathy Deficit Disorder," and it comments on Don Young's comments about issue about accusing suicide of being a social responsibility and friends responsible and all that, the whole scandal that came out of that. And I would just like to know, I find something very interesting about your record. I'm looking at the voter pamphlet, and it says you were not only a first lieutenant in the Army National Guard, but you're a returned Peace Corps volunteer, which I find is a very yin-yang kind of a worldview there. Could you talk about that a little bit? And where is your empathy indicator, index kind of going on this regard?
Thanks, Rich.
Thank you, Rich. It's funny. I do get that question sometimes. How can you serve both in the Army Guard, and I continue to serve in the Army Guard, and have been in the Peace Corps? I don't really see them as mutually exclusive, I have to say. I don't even see them as contradictory. And when I was in the Peace Corps, we had several people who had gone basically from fighting the war in Iraq to the Peace Corps. They had come home, they had left the Army, and they'd gone into the Peace Corps, which you can do. If you're in an intelligence service, you can't be in the Peace Corps. But if you serve in the military, it's not a problem in a non-intelligence capacity. And I think what it boils down to is two things. One is a belief that the world can be made a better place. I do think that you get a lot of people in both of those organizations who think that we can make things better. And maybe there's a different approach in different places, but we can make things better. And the second is about national service or just public service more broadly. You want to serve your state. You want to serve your country. And these are two great ways to do that. It's funny. I never really saw them as mutually exclusive, although I could see how some people might see that.
All right. Let's go to Bethel now. Eric is on the line from Bethel. Good morning, Eric.
Hi. Good morning. I had a question regarding rural energy.
Yes.
And you touched on it a little bit earlier. Have you had a chance to look at the Alaska Grid project? It's just a proposal, and it's essentially utilizing a large-scale natural gas-fired power plant, the scale of which, maybe you can answer from it right now.
Yeah. I haven't heard of that proposal. I'd be very interested to see it. I know that if we had one massive unit, we'd have a problem with spinning reserve, as they call it, unless it was sort of broken out into smaller units, because we can't put so much of our capacity in one place if it goes down, and I'm sure you know the details there. But I will say, whether it's that kind of proposal or what I really want to see is a small-scale distributed alternative energy generation all over the state, so that we have villages and communities that are as self-sufficient as possible. Now, and this is not for a broader climate change reason, although perhaps we'll talk about climate change later, but for simple dollars and cents, because it's so expensive to bring in fuel into rural Alaska, and it's driving people from their homes. So things that might not make sense in the lower 48 in terms of alternative energy actually make economic sense in Alaska, and that will give us the opportunity to develop technologies and be a leader in these things. Now, in some places, that won't be practical, and so perhaps something like a large-scale generation in a centralized location with a grid that goes out will be more effective and likely. But we have to take an everything above approach. We have to do everything we can. We have to bring down the cost of energy in this state, not just for people's homes and where they live, but also for business and for the military. I mean, there are lots of users that want to be here, that want to use power here, and it's not economically feasible. And so we have to bring down the cost of energy.
Forrest, you have said in the past that your political ideas align more closely with Republicans when it comes to resource development. Is that a true statement, or how would you
you know, it depends on how you define the two, sure, views, because Senator Begich has been very pro resource development, and yet he's accused of all these ridiculous things about not being. So I don't think in this state there's really a clear distinction between Democrats and Republicans on resource development. It is a, you know, you're an Alaskan first and foremost.
Well, let's go through a few of those. Okay. ANWR, the NPRA, sure, offshore,
yep,
coal. What are your thoughts, yeah, about some of these big proposals?
Sure. I support developing CD5 and the other developments that will come after CD5. But I do think it's very important that those oil companies work with the local communities and make sure that, again, they get buy-in. And sometimes there's some worry there. But I support developing that part of the NPRA. I also support the offshore development on the shelf. Although we have to put in place, and we're working to do that now, we have to put in place the resources, the spill response, and also the Coast Guard for not just Shell, but also for the now open Northwest Passage, or the soon to be open Northwest Passage. We have to make sure we have our ducks in a row when it comes to response. And look, I grew up in Cordova, so oil spills is still the Exxon Valdez is one of the most important events in our history as this community, and it's very fresh in our mind. So I do believe that you have to have spill response there. I think Shell has been open to that and has done things working with the government on that. So those are the two. The last one was ANWR. I do support opening ANWR, although I do have a slightly different approach. I favor what I call contingent development. And what I mean by contingent development is this. So when I speak with people, representatives from the oil industry, what they tell me is we can absolutely develop ANWR safely. It will not impact the Caribou. But, Reagan said, trust but verify. And I don't want to risk the food security of the Gwich'in people up there. So we can write the law in such a way where we do this in stages, where there's monitoring, where we're using the best science and the best practices, where we don't just go all in all at once, but we do it in such a way where, stage one, stage two, stage three, and we see, is it impacting the caribou? Is the caribou declining? We could even write in such a way where, regardless of the reason the caribou declined, if they decline past a certain point, we pull the plug. But I think if we believe the oil company's own rhetoric, we could write the law in such a way where there's not very much risk to them, again, if they can do what they say they can do, but also minimize the risks to the people in that region, the Gwich'in people in particular, who rely on that food source.
We're going to bring in another caller here in just a moment, but I also want you to comment on the idea of the federal government subsidizing the energy industry, both the fossil fuel industry and renewables. Is that an appropriate role for the federal government?
Well, we've done it for a very long time, and we are a fossil fuel producing state. So a lot of those programs do benefit this state, and I wouldn't be fighting to scale back those programs necessarily, the ones for the fossil fuels, but I would be fighting to try to get renewables on a more equal footing and try to give them the support that they need to develop these energies. And again, it's not for some broader climate change reason, although those might be good reasons too. For me, it's a dollars and cents issue in the rural communities, and perhaps that broader effect will be ancillary. But there are communities where the cost of energy is too high, where alternative energies can make a real, real impact, and we should be allowing them to have that same sort of kickstart, so that they can get developing their technologies as well, so that we can use them.
Janet is on the line in Anchorage. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. I would like to know what, if anything, then that you would hope to do for the environment. Our ocean is becoming increasingly acidified,
yes,
and the permafrost is melting, and the permafrost is just a carbon sink, and our shores are eroding away.
Sure.
Please give me some hope.
Sure. You know, I believe we have to innovate our way out of this, and I think we will. And I think there's already some positive signs here in Alaska. So, for example, it's already scheduled. This is unconnected from the 111 deregulation. They are going to take Beluga Power Plant offline, and they're going to replace it with a newer, cleaner facility here in South Central. That's one of the biggest power plants in the state, and that's an important step for us to reach that 26% goal. Regardless of how I feel about the 26% goal, we're probably going to reach it, especially if we develop things like natural gas as well. Which can also help us change off of some other fuels, or at least supplement and bring down our cost of energy. But it's undeniable that climate change is happening here in the state. I mean, we see it with erosion in Shishmaref. We see it with rising paralytic shellfish poisoning, which is likely to be caused by the fact that some of the water there isn't cold enough, long enough to kill off the microorganism. We see it, what appears we're seeing it in our fish stocks as well. And we're seeing it with some of the ocean acidification, as you said. Ocean acidification is a huge problem and something we have to work on. There's no question. And so for me, it's a question of not the sort of top-down regulatory approach of we're going to make this punitive, because there are people who frankly can't afford it. There are people who can't afford it in a lot of Alaskan communities. But rather, we're going to develop new technologies. We're going to develop energy conservation technologies that are going to help people bring down costs and reduce carbon emissions. So yesterday, I had the chance to go to the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks. And the work they're doing is just tremendous. And if we could take some of they have buildings that use 80% less energy than some of the other ones. They put one up in Anaktuvik Pass. If we could put more of those kind of buildings around the state, we would come a long way to doing our part in reducing total carbon emissions while simultaneously helping the pocketbooks of our communities.
Democratic challenger for U.S. House, Forrest Dunbar, is our guest, and we will take more calls and more questions as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Our guest today is U.S. House candidate, Democrat Forrest Dunbar. Don Young was offered time on Talk of Alaska this week, but his schedule did not allow for him to be on with us this week. So we are going to try to plow through a few more calls in our last few minutes here. Ronald is in Caltag. Good morning, Ronald.
Good morning. I'd like to ask Forrest, and this pertains to him and all the other politicians that's up for electorials. When we go firefighting out of state, and some village get in trouble, one particular village get in trouble, they blackball the whole state of Alaska.
Right.
Now, to me, that's not fair to the state of Alaska, because 80 to 90% of Alaska is wildland firefighters.
Right.
And due to lack of jobs and lack of resources, that's the only job we have that we depend on is wildland firefighting.
Sure. No, someone at AFN came up and brought me this exact issue. I you know, as you probably know, I worked as a wildland firefighter for a summer out of Fort Wainwright. I worked beside a lot of village crews. I know the importance that has in those communities and the money it brings in, and also the great job that they do. So I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong to blackball every Alaskan crew based on the behavior of one. We don't see that in a lot of other contexts, right? So I think what we need to do, though, we need to reach out to California and Nevada and other states. And federal agencies, if need be, and work across the work this out, because it's wrong. It's wrong that one village's behavior, or just a couple people in one village's behavior, would be imputed to every crew. That is mistaken, and I would fight to allow our village crews to, again, have that economic opportunity to go and fight fires in the lower 48.
Thanks for that call from Caltag. We're going to move now to North Pole. Rick is in North Pole. Rick, do you have a question?
Yes, good morning. First thing I want to say is thank you very much for running. That's really a big deal, because a lot of people don't want to take on somebody entrenched like Don Young. However, I'm calling about the PM 2.5. You touched on it a little bit a minute ago. You know, there are people out here that are being blamed for the wood, burning wood, and that's not totally the whole thing. The other thing on that is, you know, we burn a lot of coal in Alaska.
Yep.
And nobody's going after these big plants, but yet they're talking about shutting down wood stoves for the people. This is an inversion problem, you know, because we live in a valley here, a bowl. And when it gets 60 below zero, I work outdoors.
Yeah.
I totally hear people on the breathing.
Right.
And I understand that. But to have senior citizens have to pick, do I buy oil? Do I take medicine?
Yep.
Do I do this? Do I do that? And
your
that
question,
is what
Rick?
Happens.
Yeah.
Do you have a question?
My question is a way to fight. Is there a way to fight the EPA back on this? And once again, NPR, you're doing a great job on this program. I love it. First time caller also.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks, Rick. EPA?
This is a great question. And it's so, you know, when I was fighting fire, I breathed wood smoke for a whole summer. And it's not great. We don't want it there. And, you know, as much as possible. And, you know, BRAC considers air quality when they're deciding whether or not to put troops somewhere. So there are great reasons to keep to trying to improve Fairbanks' air quality. That being said, people are making economic decisions. You know, I had a wood stove when I was a kid. We did it because that was what we couldn't afford anything else. And that's how a lot of people are. And he's talking about senior citizens, absolutely, on fixed incomes. They cannot support, they cannot afford heating oil, which is hugely expensive. So what we need to do, and I actually approve that, I'm glad that the Borough Assembly now has take some control. But I think what we need to do is bills, and there's already a bill pending, that would allow people in non-attainment zones to get a low interest or no interest loans or even grants to help them swap out the older wood stoves for newer wood stoves. Those would help reduce PM 2.5, and they would save money because they burn far less wood. We also are seeing a wood pellet industry being developed. We're seeing natural gas. We can absolutely get out from under this. We don't need the EPA in there. We can and should do this at the local level in Fairbanks. But if I was in Congress, I would help pass laws to allow federal funding to help people in non-attainment zones like Fairbanks.
Forrest Dunbar has been our guest today. We only have about a minute left, Forrest.
Okay.
What about job development for Alaska? Give us your thoughts on how you could help that if you were sent to Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. Well, I've been saying this all campaign. This to me is the single biggest issue. This is the primary challenge for my generation. We probably have enough oil and gas jobs to last me and my generation until we retire. And hopefully we'll continue to develop those that we've talked about earlier. But for our children and our grandchildren, we have to be looking for other sources of jobs as well. That means tourism. It means sustainable fisheries. It means high tech. It means everything. And we have to have that open mind and be working to build infrastructure so we can have the large ships home ported here, so we can have high tech firms come here. And that means low cost energy. It means other kinds of high tech infrastructure. Those are the kind of things I would fight for in Congress every day. We have to be diversifying Alaska's economy. We're going to be developing our resources. There's no question. I will fight for that. But we have to diversify our Alaska's economy for the long term as well, so we can have good paying jobs for people all over the state, not just in one area or the other, all over the state. We have to be looking for those jobs.
All right. Thank you so much to our guest today on Talk of Alaska, Forrest Dunbar, Democratic challenger for U.S. House. Don Young was offered time but could not make it for Talk of Alaska this week. Thanks to Monica Goki, our engineer, Josh Edge, and whoever else was answering phones today. I'm Lori Townsend. Steve Heimel will be back with you next week for Talk of Alaska. Have a good day.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network and by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.